Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deb Brown Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of May. This week we are very pleased to have as the main part of our show, part two of Kate Dwyer's interview with Olympic National Park's botanist David Allen, speaking about the amazing restoration project that they've been orchestrating up the Elwha River. And we have the additional treat of having Sunny Flores here to help share observations and events with us. Welcome to this side of the mic, Sunny.
I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. Sunny is doing us the great favor of helping out as our sound engineer and co-host, while Charlie Fleischman is off visiting relatives in Iceland. But before we get to any of that, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. This is one of my very favorite sounds. I realize that it will not be a mystery sound to many of you who like to hike at higher elevations, but I couldn't resist choosing it this week because I heard it for the first time this year a few days ago.
On our last show, we reported on the recent grim news from the marine world, with several invasive European green crabs being found in our area off Dungeness Spit. This week, we have more information, with scientists stating that they think they know what brought the crabs into Washington's inland waters last year.
In short, they think it was the blob. That was the temporary expanse of abnormally warm water off the West Coast from 2013 to late 2015. Green crab have lived for years in isolated pockets on the outer West Coast, particularly on western Vancouver Island. They never made it inland, however, past the cold water in the Strait of Juan de Fuca.
A couple years ago, the blob, on top of El Nino conditions, made way for warmer water that allowed green crab to thrive in traditionally cold waters. Then strong winds blew the water inland that likely carried crab larvae, according to the study by research from Oregon State University and the Canadian government.
Green crab can wreak havoc on local ecosystems by eating native oysters, clams, and tearing up eelgrass beds while searching for food. Last week, we learned the shocking fact that one crab can eat up to 45 clams each day. The only encouraging fact in all this is that with the blob now dissipated, researchers predict that no more green crab will enter the Salish Sea anytime soon. Our thanks to radio station KUOW for sharing this news and to OSU for funding the research. If you want to read more details, the information has just been published in the Journal of Shellfish Research.
In the good news department, we had an inspiring report last week from the Jefferson Land Trust telling us about a recent field trip. 150 first and second graders from Grant Street Elementary School came out to Alahi Preserve, bringing with them the coho salmon fry that they've been raising in their class. It was a joy to see them as they brought the tiny fish in cups one by one into the Chimicum Creek and watched as the fish made themselves at home. Go to saveland.org and click on news and events to see lots of sweet photos of their day in the field, learning how to be our future land stewards.
They're really sweet pictures, too. I went and looked at them, and yeah, it does your heart good to see it. Al Latham sent us the following email. Happy May Day. All the April showers should bring lots of May flowers. The slightly off-center Kokoras reporting station here, 5 miles south of Chimicum precipitation report, is as follows. For the month of April, 3.99 inches of rain, with 2.5 being average. The water year, which is considered to be October through September, accumulation to date is 36.11 inches, with 27.45 being average. Note, 34.56 inches is the average for the whole water year, so we are already past it. And this total was before the very unusual thunderstorms and downpours that we experienced this past week. So it will be especially interesting to learn what it is up to now. According to the NOAA Climate Weather Prediction Center, for the next 8 to 14 days, we can expect warmer than normal temperatures. Yay!
That's right.
And normal rainfall. For May, they predict normal for both temperature and rain. For May through July, they're predicting slightly warmer than usual with normal rainfall.
And as far as Mayflowers go, Al has been right. There are lots of lovely Mayflowers out right now. Our native rhododendrons are just starting to open their huge, showy pink blossoms right on time to be in fine form for Rhodie weekend. And salal, one of the most common but most lovely of our native understory shrubs, is starting to display its beautiful white and pink tinged bells. Our pocket of native prairie, the Kaitai Prairie at the edge of the golf course right across the radio station, is at its peak right now, and you really should go check it out. The contrast of bright yellow lomatium and the purple-blue common camas is stunning. At higher elevations, the beautiful white fawn lilies can be seen blooming along the uphill side of the road as you head up the Dungeness Valley just above the Dungeness River Campground.
There are also a bunch of trillium up in there. It's so beautiful and smells so good. There continue to be lots of cool birds migrating through or arriving for their breeding season here. Ron Sykes of Admiralty Audubon wrote in to tell us of an exciting visitor to the Kaitai Nature Park last week. Quote, a Nashville warbler was feeding in a willow next to the South Trail. It was near the west end of the trail. I believe it is a new species for the park's history list, unquote. The Nashville warbler is primarily an eastern Washington species, with our equivalent on the west side being the orange-crowned warbler. These birds are common in appropriate habitats through the eastern part of the state from mid-April to late August. In western Washington, they can be found in scattered pockets in western Clark and Skamania counties and along the upper Skagit River. Some years, a small number can be found migrating through western Washington. They were formerly found in the Gary Oak woodlands of South Puget Sound as well. Our thanks to Ron for the heads up and to birdweb.org for the additional information.
Rick Altman phoned to tell us of an amazing sight that a friend of his recorded out near Dungeness Spit. First, he watched a northern harrier hunt down a mouse in a nearby field. But before it could fly off with it, a red-tailed hawk flew down to startle the harrier, making it drop the mouse. Before it hit the ground, the red-tailed snatched it in midair. But then an even more amazing thing happened. The harrier flew off in pursuit of its meal, causing the red-tail to drop the mouse, whereupon the harrier retrieved it, still without the prey touching the ground.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it?
That is amazing.
I've meanwhile been witnessing intraspecific competition at my place, where barred owls have been sparring over territory. Barred owls have become increasingly common in my woods over the past few years, and I have known since the late 1990s that there's been at least one pair nesting in the area. But the other evening near sunset, I was able to see and hear what must have been the resident pair trying to drive off another male intruder. You can tell the sexes apart because both sexes vocalize, with the female usually sounding distinctively higher than the male, even though she is considerably larger in size. I could hear a male calling to the north, coming nearer, while both members of the resident pair became increasingly more vocal and agitated, flapping loudly as they moved from tree to tree. They never did physically attack the other bird that I could see or hear, but just kept it at bay by vocalizing and flying along the edges of what they considered to be their property until it moved off. And you, Sonny, were telling me about a cool thing that you saw just today.
Yes,
right?
Yes. This morning I just had my coffee and I was going outside to do some things out around our home. And I heard a screeching. So when I opened the front door of our home, there was two animals wrestling. And I thought it was a squirrel fighting. But I realized it was a rabbit. And I thought the other one was a squirrel. A baby rabbit took off, hung around the front yard for a little bit. And then it went under our deck. And then I went out to the garage. And then a weasel came out from under our deck, which I've never seen a weasel where I live.
There are weasels a lot more than you'd think. But they're kind of skulky. So I've seen them right in town before, running across the road. And they're very voracious predators.
I was a little bit relieved. I thought, God, our squirrels have gone mad and they're killing rabbits.
Yeah, they're cool animals. And here's promise part two of our guest host Kate Dwyer's interview with David Allen of the Olympic National Park's Elwha Dam Restoration Team. Part one aired about 6 weeks ago and can be found as a podcast at kptz.org if you want to listen to the show in its entirety.
On the March 22nd episode of Nature Now, David Allen, director of the Matt Albright Native Plant Center in Sequim, described the scope, design, and planning for the massive plant restoration in the Elwha River after dam removals. The Native Plant Center's mission is to collect, grow and acquire all the seeds and plants for the restoration. They also oversee planting and seeding. So, Dave, in our first interview, you described the intricate design of the project and some of the anticipated issues or problems. Well, now that you've had 3 seasons of planting, let's hear about how it's going in real life. And my first question is, are you trying to create a exact replica of how the river used to be or how other similar river bottoms are now?
That was one of the great challenges of the project, is that there were no models that we could look at and say we want to recreate something. And in restoration, perhaps that's not the right question anyway, because conditions change. And here you have vastly different conditions from the surrounding area, and that's created from the reservoir, from our use by damming the river. You had this collection of almost 100 years of sediment, and it's in a different configuration. It's there now where it never would have been before, and mm-hmm. now it's exposed. So the great thing, especially on the coarse sediment, is that the river lupins and other herbaceous perennials are taking hold and slowly will change that. But it will take thousands of years.
Thousands?
Or thousands
okay.
of years to make soil.
Uh-huh.
And plants are the vegetation type. Plant communities are a reflection of the soil. The two work hand in hand.
In our last interview, you referred to this site as being almost like mine reclamation because of the amount of rubble and rock and mineral soils and so on. So that gives an idea of what you're talking about, why it might take thousands of years.
Yes. So the vegetation that will be in the Mills area along that stretch of the river will not be the same. It won't reflect the surrounding lowland hemlock forest because the soil's not there.
Right.
So it will be something new. And what it will be, I can't really tell you.
You guys are playing God.
Right. We introduce a lot of plants and we think that nature might take it on certain trajectories. And to some degree, the trajectory that nature will take it is predicated somewhat on what we've introduced there. But I can't tell you what's going to predominate, what's going to do well, what's not going to do well over time. But I can tell you it will not look like the surrounding hemlock forest. So if you come back 300 years from now, if you could, mm-hmm. and looked at this site, and you would say, hey, why is this so different
interesting.
Than right over there? So maybe I can meet you at the dam overlook in 300 years and we talk about it.
Yeah, I got my time machine all revved up here. I know you've had some setbacks, that everybody does in a project like this, so floods maybe, and how about invasive weeds? Have they been a huge issue?
Well, they've been an important concern from the get-go. So actually, before the dams came down, before anything happened, we went with our partner, the Lower Elwha Clown Tribe, and surveyed and tried to reduce, control, get rid of as many invasive exotic plants as we could find all along Aldwell and Mills. That's years before the project started.
Wow.
As far as dam removal. And we've been doing the same thing all during the course of the project. And it needs to continue well after the project. Because, again, once you open up any scar on the land and you have a disturbed area, then the thing that wants to come in most readily mm-hmm. are weeds, plants mm-hmm. that are perfectly adapted to those conditions.
So has it been fairly successful? Have you got invasives coming in by seed or not?
There are. There are invasives that still pop up and come in. We're still controlling them as mm-hmm. best we can. And that will be an ongoing issue.
Right.
So because some of the sites, with again, depending on the sediment, resist plants of all types.
Right.
Others are pretty easy for plants to grow in. So things like reed canary grass and Scott's broom and Canada thistle are very difficult to control and take constant attention.
I'm wondering, I know there was 20 years of planning into this, and as you just mentioned, people weeding years in advance. So I know you had a lot of ideas and models of what would happen. So I'm curious what the surprises were that you and all the other scientists didn't anticipate.
there's individual success stories in some of the plants and failures in some of the plants. And at the inception of the project, I'm trying to think of all the plants that I believe will do well in these sites, mm-hmm. not knowing what the sites would look like yet, but still. And you think things that would do well, like Linus or Ingelkraut, this bush honeysuckle, which grows anywhere. Mm-hmm. I don't care where it is. It's sunny, dry, or shady, wet, lots of rain, no rain. It grows anywhere.
Total generalist.
And you think, okay, it's a great generalist. You plant that out, it would grow a lot of it, and yeah, it all died.
Oh.
And what the heck? Other things, like cottonwood. Cottonwood is the hero of this place. And you would think cottonwood, which is a riparian species, it grows on old floodplains. That's where it grows. But you plant this thing, and it grows so fast, and it wants to find water. It races down as far as it can go to find water, and so it survives on these terrible, hostile, rocky spots where you think it shouldn't be, and yet there it is. It does.
Wow.
Also, the fecundancy of nature. It's just something to behold.
Uh-huh.
It's a really amazing...
It's like being at the beginning of time or something, isn't it? Or just after a glacier moved out. Like a grand experiment.
It is that. And it's great to stand back and watch what nature does.
Yeah. Well, tell me, there's a lot of manual labor that goes into this. And I've helped out at the greenhouse and collecting seeds, but the backbreaking work of planting I haven't done. So tell us how the project's organized and who's paying for all this.
We are funded through the ELWA project.
Hmm.
That was that $325 million project that went through Congress, and Norm Dix got the appropriations. And so that was the money. Now, of that, $5 million went to revegetation originally. So then we've also been lucky enough to, again, with our partner, especially the Lower Elwha Klamath Tribe, to utilize some salmon recovery funding monies. That helped us out tremendously. We were able to hire seasonals, and so people can work up to 6 months with the Park Service. We were able to have a contract with Washington Conservation Corps, which has been the backbone of our work crew, especially headed up in the early years by Justin Zarzesny. They did all the backbreaking work of trails and building little bridges and moving plants and doing so much of the plantings, which is not easy work.
Mm-mm.
And then we have this wonderful, wonderful cadre of interns that have come in, people working on their master's degrees that have contributed, and most importantly are the volunteers, thousands and thousands of hours by hundreds of people that either, whether they're washing a pot at the nursery or they're out planting, which is the most fun thing, even in miserable weather, they're all contributing to this effort. They've helped build the facilities here. Just people do everything. I'm just constantly amazed, and I am so filled with gratitude for their efforts and their contributions.
Okay, let me say something right here. Dear listeners, if you would like to be involved, how do we contact Dave? Because it is fun. I've volunteered a couple times over there, and one day they had me scraping spores off the back of a fern. Another day I was rolling Doug fir cones in my hands to get the seeds out. I mean, it's really a trip, and they love volunteers. So, Dave, how do they get in touch to be a volunteer?
Well, it's pretty easy. You can just call us here at the nursery at 360-683-0757.
Right. And if you don't have a pencil to write that down, you can also find them through the Olympic National Park Elwha River Restoration page.
Exactly.
Okay. It seems to me that not just for you, but all the hundreds of scientists who've worked on that project, that this must be the opportunity of a lifetime. You think of like NASA in the 60s and these guys working on the genome project and stuff. Is it a thrill for you?
This is the best job imaginable for me. And yes, to be part of this project, to be part of this whole experience is beyond the pale. It's just the best thing that could ever happen to me. And it's a great thing that's happening for the planet. It's a small thing, but just to be able to do something constructive and to be able to contribute a small amount of good, that's a wonderful feeling.
Yes.
And
meaningful work. So, we all want meaningful work, and you sure got it.
And they get to deal with plants and see life happen and blossom before you. And that, again, is something that is so rewarding, and it is fulfilling, and it gives one hope.
Right. It would seem that your work with the plant restoration and a lot of the other work there will become models for future dam removals, which are probably inevitable. Is that one of the ways that you work or do your reports and so on, with that in mind, future modeling?
This project might be somewhat unique in that we had so much sediment. Mm-hmm. Other dams might not have this level of sediment or this type of sediment, which is extremely nutrient poor. So it's not like putting a dam on the Mississippi or someplace where you have rich farmland and that's your sediment and everything's going to grow out of that. Other dams will have no sediment. Say, if you took out Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite, there's no sediment there at all. Everything is different. One thing that will translate is that there are critical times for success. And when taking the water down in a piecemeal fashion, taking the dams down in a piecemeal fashion, letting the water levels come down and then sit, it gave plants an opportunity to seed themselves in at just the right time when the sediment was saturated or near saturated, and so then they could grow. So it was the luck of the drawdown, and that was a kind of a byproduct of the methodology, but it really was instructive as to making the conditions right as you can so that nature has an opportunity to fill the void.
Not just randomly take a dam down, but take it down when the plants have the best chance of success and in succession. Well, that's all the time we have for this interview today, but it's really been fascinating. Thank you for all your good, meaningful work, Dave.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And now we have a few upcoming events to tell you about, all of them sponsored by the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society.
On Saturday, the 13th of May, we'll be very busy with the International Birdathon happening all day and a class on spring sounds scheduled for 10 a.m. to noon at their Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Sequim.
Then on Tuesday morning, May 16th, there's a training for those who would like to help with a pigeon guillemot monitoring effort taking place on our beaches later this summer.
And lastly, at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, May 17th, come hear storyteller and former National Park Ranger Ingrid Nixon speaking about birds and legend and folklore. For more information on any or all of these fine events, please go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a hermit thrush, and one of the most beautiful calls to be heard in our area, or anywhere, in my opinion. This description of the song is from Cornell Ornithology Lab's great 5-CD set, Bird Songs of the Pacific Northwest. Quote, "Song is ethereal and flute-like. It begins with a clear, whistled note, followed by a series of lilting phrases. No other woodland thrush starts its song with a single note." Unquote. There are two species of spot-breasted thrushes found in western Washington, the hermit thrush and the equally beloved Swainson's thrush, which is due to arrive in our area soon for the breeding season. The two species are very similar visually. The hermit thrush's tail and rump are a shade redder than the rest of its brown upper parts, unlike the more uniform coloration of the Swainson's back and tail, and it has a unique habit of cocking its tail and slowly lowering it while giving its call note. The spots on its breast are also solid black, darker than those of the Swainson's, and it is more heavily spotted, with the spots beginning to run together. Hermit thrushes are common at high elevations in coniferous forests throughout Washington during the summer. They usually replace Swainson's thrush at high elevations in the Cascade and Olympic Mountains during the breeding season, with many of them returning to the low elevations to spend the fall and winter with us. Most Swainson's thrush heads south for the winter, so any spotted thrush that you see here in the winter will almost certainly be a hermit's thrush. They are very quiet during the breeding season, however, so in order to hear their lovely song, you will have to take a hike in the mountains this spring and summer. Another good reason to go up to the mountains. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of May. Thanks so much for joining me, Sunny.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, oh, great. And thanks to all of you for listening also. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Sunny Flores. Closing music is Don't Dam the River, performed by the Emmett Bauer Band.